I am so loving this spot. I've sat so many retreats and befriended this tree, and now this tree is right here listening to this talk. It's really extraordinary. So welcome everyone. So Dogen, a Japanese Buddhist priest and founder of the Soto Zen school, he wrote, "To study the Buddha way is to study the self. To study the self is to forget the self. To forget the self is to be actualized by myriad things." And I titled this talk, Remembering We Are Earth Beings. And in it, I wanted to engage with some different ideas related to how Dharma practice can help us to forget the self, to remember that we are myriad things. So how nature-based practice really invites us to recognize our interdependence, to really see this habit that we have of separation and engage in a path of belonging. So I want to begin by welcoming us here. And recognizing the ancestors of this place, of these lands, human and non-human. All who are living here amongst us now. And all of our ancestors, our wider sanghas. Welcoming each one of us. I have kind of an easy task too, because I'll share some words, but really, you know, this is doing the profound teaching, right? So as the sky darkens and the moon becomes more visible and the breeze gets cooler, you know, we're tuning into all of these other languages of teachings. But speaking of nature-based practice, what are we talking about is nature? And I wouldn't be surprised if we all have different answers to that question. What is nature? I have a PhD in environmental sociology, and I've taught all of these courses on the topic of the environment and nature, and had so many conversations, you know, deconstructing these ideas of nature, of wilderness, and really also problematizing the concept of nature. And in many ways that can be helpful, because it you know, in exploring our definitions of nature, we start to see what's included and what's excluded, and assumptions we might be making, what is valued, what's not valued, and how in many times and cases our ideas of nature and wilderness have caused harm, you know, have rendered invisible native peoples, for example. So I'm bringing in curiosity, not an answer to this question of what is nature. But we have this time together to allow nature, allow Dharma to teach us, what we might consider to be nature. You know, what is my nature? Gary Snyder, a poet and Zen practitioner and visionary in many ways, he wrote, "To speak of wilderness is to speak of wholeness. human beings came out of that wholeness. And this word that we use, Dharma, you know, the second of the three refuges that I spoke to last night, can be understood as the teachings of the Buddha, and also translated oftentimes as nature, as the way things are. So here we are, Dharma, nature, the way things are. And what makes this nature-based practice? And I'd like to suggest perhaps that there are these places, we might call them nature, where we can really see clearly, we can connect with and see clearly the sort of dharmic unfolding of life, where it's the beauty of life is able to flow in an unimpeded kind of way. You know, where we can really live within these larger rhythms of sunrise and sunset and of the seasons, without being insulated in buildings of temperature control, you know, where we can get really quiet and listen to that spotted towhee right there, scrabbling around in the leaves. I know there's a Potawatomi term for the sound a mushroom makes as it bursts out of the earth. And I can't remember the term, but wow, we can get that quiet. So I do think there's something about being out here and slowing down and being open to the elements, to the other beings here, you know, sitting, wandering on the earth. And we can remember the animal nature of our own bodies, you know, not so separate from the four-legged and the winged and the scaled that share this earth with us. So to really remember that we're part of this ecology of things. There they are. So remembering we're earth beings. So, as many of you know, the Buddhist practice really hinges in many ways on this concept of sati, of mindfulness, this open, non-judgmental presence. It's like direct sensing of what's happening in the present moment. So in meditation practice, we sit down and we bring our attention to this present moment again and again. And we start to get more intimate with what it is to be alive. You know, and we also get to be more intimate with the ways we create suffering and conflict. You know, we start to feel how when we want things to be different, there's this internal tension inside when we resist the way things are. That we're creating these layers of separation in ourselves. And sati mindfulness, it's this ingredient that helps us to see what's happening with this non-judgmental awareness, to allow it. And so on retreat, we have this like really beautiful opportunity to drop down and ask these questions of, you know, what is it to be human? What is it when I suffer? What is it to be alive? What's the nature of being? And nature-based practice, you know, being outside in places that have been given this freedom to grow and live unbounded in this larger ecology of life, it offers us this lens from which we can see and experience and understand ourselves as part of this larger whole. And there's always been a support, a sort of mutual supportiveness of meditation and nature connection. As Mark was saying last night, you know, the Buddha awakened under a tree, taught under trees, born under a tree, and, you know, sent for centuries, monks and mystics and others, you know, lived and meditated in forests, in caves, in deserts, in mountains. And there's something about the stillness, the less stimulation, less human stimulation that offers us something different from the busyness of our social lives. That brings us mental space and clarity. It brings us perspective. Often inspires a sense of beauty or of curiosity, of awe, of amazement, of wonder, gratitude. And we know that nature-based practice is not always comfortable. I mean, practice is not always comfortable. But out here, you know, we get cold and we get hot. We might get bitten by insects and we might get poison oak. And we're less insulated. And then there's also, you know, what it is when we're outside and it doesn't fit our expectations of what it's supposed to be like outside. Like we hear traffic or a radio or someone else's. So these also help us to expand our capacity. This is what practice does. Pema Chodron, who's a Tibetan teacher, she wrote, "There's a common misunderstanding among all the human beings who have ever been born on the earth that the best way to live is to try to avoid pain and just try to get comfortable. You can see this even in insects and animals and birds. All of us are the same. A much more interesting, kind, adventurous, and joyful approach to life is to begin to develop our curiosity, not caring whether the object of our inquisitiveness is bitter or sweet. To lead a life that goes beyond pettiness and prejudice and always wanting to make sure that everything turns out in our own terms. To lead a more passionate, full, and delightful life than that, we must realize that we can endure a lot of pain and pleasure for the sake of finding out who we are and what this world is. How we tick and how our worlds tick. How the whole thing just is. If we're committed to comfort at any cost, as soon as we come up against the least edge of pain, we're going to run. We'll never know what's beyond that particular barrier or wall or fearful thing." So this practice, it offers us this opportunity to expand our capacity to be with everything. As she says, with the pain and the pleasure, and to get curious about it. You know, to actually befriend our experience and who we are. I don't do it as much anymore, but I went through a period where I led a lot of mountaineering and backpacking expeditions with young people, and it's hard work. We would spend months outside at times, and they would often complain and long for their social media and, you know, get grumpy about the mosquitoes and the long days, and they would always come back, you know? And there was something about that the capacity, like recognizing that they had the capacity to need it, and then coming home and feeling that, like, sense of empowerment, of confidence, of things were, the world is less scary. You know, it's like we know we can be here for ourselves. I actually, I think a lot about mindfulness as love. Like this way in which we're becoming friends with ourselves, you know, an act of befriending ourselves. And here, you know, we can really practice the internal mindfulness of breath, of thought, of emotion, as well as what's happening all around us. Really tuning, really attuning, becoming intimate. And nature-based practice also gives us this incredible lens into two of the most profound of the Buddha's teachings of anatta and anicca, of not-self and of impermanence. So they become not so abstract, actually, but really fundamentally available to us. So anicca, impermanence. And when we attend really closely to the present moment, we see everything arising, passing. You know, all our attempts to keep something from happening or keep something happening, you know, is what brings about this inner conflict. But when we really open to the flow of experience and we see that here, you know, just this day, this one day is ending. The sun has set, the moon is rising. I think I mentioned the wildflowers yesterday. I mean, they come and go so quickly. So we can really bring what we learn in nature to all aspects of our life, to recognizing the beginning, the middle, the ending of things, the dynamic flow of this life that we're part of. And then this characteristic of anatta, of no self, can also think about it as not a solitary, independent self. Like there's no such thing as a separate self. That we're deeply embedded in relationship. You know, we don't exist without each other. One of the first practices that the Buddha taught his son Rahula was a four-element meditation practice, which we'll probably do this week, I'm guessing. And he described it as a practice that has this capacity to bring us into a direct understanding of anatta. From the suttas, it's written that he said, Rahula, any form whatsoever that is past, future, or present, internal or external, blatant or subtle, common or sublime, far or near, every form is to be seen as it actually is with right discernment, as this is not mine, this is not myself, this is not what I am. There are these five properties, Rahula. Which five? The earth property, the water property, the fire property, the wind property, and the space property. So in this teaching, the Buddha is breaking down each of the elements and revealing the self as the property of the elements, or of the body, the property of the elements, the earth, all that's hard and solid in our body. This is the earth, it's not me or mine. And then likewise, the breath, this is the air, it's not me or mine. the energy that animates this body. It's the fire, not me or mine, the blood, the liquid that flows through these veins. Not me, not mine. You know, these incredible reciprocal relationships that we are. You know, this, the act of breathing, that we're in relationship with plants, that we're this part of this photosynthesizing process. And again, where does the oxygen stop and where do we begin? You're tracing a drop of water. It's all ecological principles. Thich Nhat Hanh had this teaching of a cloud and a piece of paper. He'd say, when you see this piece of paper, you see a cloud. Because without a cloud, you don't have rain. Without rain, you don't have a tree. Without a tree, you don't have a piece of paper. So we're all wrapped up in everything else. You know, the water and the winds and the grasses and the rocks and the rivers and these intricate webs of being that we're not separate from. So we take ourselves in this way less personally and yet inherently interconnected. And this is an understanding of anatta, not self. Thich Nhat Hanh wrote, when we walk, we are aware that the earth is holding our steps. But Mother Earth is not just below us, under our feet. Mother Earth is inside of us. To think that Mother Earth is only the environment outside of us, around us, is wrong. Mother Earth is inside of us. We don't need to die to go back to Mother Earth. We are already in Mother Earth. That is why we have to learn how to take refuge in her. That is the best way to heal and to nourish ourselves. This practice of being in nature and recognizing our very selves as nature, it really helps pull us out of this delusion of separation in our own lives and into this sense of belonging. I actually don't think it's such a coincidence that, you know, the world is increasingly more technologically connected, yet we're spending much more time indoors, disconnected from the ecology of things. And humans are lonelier than ever before. So what is it when we open our hearts to this truth of our interconnectedness? We really rediscover our sense of our own belonging. When I was an early teenager, I was pretty misanthropic, and I was so cynical about the world for a little while there, just seeing all of the, felt like very needless destruction in the name of greed. And I played a lot of music at the time, and when I got into high school, my jazz teacher there encouraged me to get private music lessons, and I'd never done that before, so I didn't even really know how to do that. But I went to a music store where I used to get my reeds. I play the saxophone, and saw all these, you know, names of people who were offering private lessons on a bulletin board. And so I just kind of cold called people, and the person I ended up with lived in the woods with his wife, and I used to go up there and have these lessons. And I remember one day, I don't remember what he asked me, but the teacher asked me something, and I said in a very like adolescent way, you know, what does it matter? People only care about money anyway, or something like that. And he said, put your horn down. Put my saxophone down. And then he took me outside, and it turned out that he was part of a circle of druids who studied the alchemy, a kind of Celtic land-based spirituality, and he apprenticed me. I was like, you know, 16 years old, and I would spend every weekend going out into the mountains with him and others from that circle, and it was very physically demanding practice. We would do this barefoot trail running, and we'd dip in these cold creeks, and we'd have to stay in for a certain amount of time, get all chilled. And but we also learned about listening for sign and communicating with more than human. And I had never even considered that. You know, it was just not. I always loved nature and being in nature, but you know, now I think that the idea of only being able to communicate with other humans feels so impoverished. But at the time, that was the lens I was seeing the world through, and it really did. That practice and those practices and teachings really saved my life in certain ways. You know, just developing that sense of belonging in this mystical, magical world that speaks so many different languages. I think it can be helpful too to see that this delusion of separation doesn't just happen within our own individual consciousness, but on a much bigger scale and in more collective levels. You know, social levels, political, cultural, you know, through these shared opinions and views and reactions, you know, these groups and communities can perpetuate these stories of separation, and we see these in so many oppressive systems that play out in hierarchies between human cultures and races and genders, between humans and nature, between humans and non-humans. And I see climate change as a symptom of this much greater disconnection that's bred from this illusion of separation and supported by these systems whose survival is really contingent upon us feeding this sense of scarcity or lack. I think, in a way, a response to climate injustice is not believing those worldviews that are so fundamentally alienating. You know, not believing that we need the next thing to be happy. There's Robin Wall Kirmer. She's a Potawatomi biologist, ecologist, writer, teacher, and she tells a story about asking, she wrote a book called Braiding Sweetgrass, and she tells this story of asking her class of biology students, do you love nature? And all of them raise their hands. And then she asks, does nature love you? And I don't recall, maybe one person raises their hand, but hardly anyone raises their hand. And she describes this kind of incongruity as a sign of how in dominant culture we've really grown up lacking this sense of belonging and of reciprocity. You know, what it is, I guess I kind of stumbled into learning, you know, to have conversations with lizards and hawks and listen to the earth and be listened to. You know, this kind of listening, it's a form of reciprocity, and it's also an expression of love. And I've really found that it can be one of the greatest gifts that we can give, you know, to listen, to pay attention, to allow ourselves to receive what is to be heard. The Buddha's Eightfold Path, one of the steps is often translated as wise attention or proper attention. That's yoniso manasikara. But my teacher, Gil Fronsdell, has done some work translating this term, yoniso manasikara. And he says that these translations of wise attention, of proper attention, they don't actually speak to the what is referred to by this symbolic reference to yoniso, the womb space. And so that this attention, actually, he translates it as profound attention. You know, this attention that operates outside of conceptual constructs, but it actually is coming from the core of our being. You know, this profound attention. And this profound attention, it's this natural source from which wholesome states associated with the Buddhist path are nurtured and grow. So there's in the suttas, it says 9 mental activities, and this is Gill's translation, so that 9 mental activities are rooted in profound attention. When there is profound attention, gladness is born. From gladness, joy is born. From joy, the body calms. When the body is calm, happiness is felt. When there is happiness, the mind becomes unified. With a unified mind, one knows and sees things as they are. Knowing and seeing things as they are, one becomes disenchanted. A disenchanted one becomes dispassionate, and a dispassionate one is liberated. So this profound attention is what ultimately can lead us to full liberation, according to this sequence in the suttas. So our practice gives us these tools to listen, to attend to both what nourishes and inspires us, as well as attend to the painful dimensions of our experience, the uncomfortable ones, increasing our capacity to be with it all. And in being with it all, you know, sometimes the mind can, if it's really working with challenge, with painful experience, you know, what is it to nourish and gladden the mind? And goodness, I mean, being out here, there are so many opportunities to see beauty, you know, see that which delights, hear that which delights, feel that which delights, which gladdens the mind. You know, being grateful gladdens the mind. Grateful for the foods that we get to eat that come from the earth, that are served by so many hands and watered by the rains and given energy from the sun and then become our own bodies. I mean, it is a mysterious, magical experience, eating. Howard Thurman, an African-American theologian and activist, he wrote, this is probably familiar to many of you, "Don't ask what the world needs. Ask what makes you come alive and go do that. Because what the world needs is people who have come alive." And one way we come alive is by recognizing deeply that we are life, and that life runs through us, shapes us, connects us to all beings. And the more we learn to listen, the more we might come awake to this understanding. Dogen again, "When you know the place where you are, practice begins." Knowing the place we are, and the many ways to listen from this place. So I invite us all in this moment, actually, to just spend a few minutes together. I'm coming to the end of the talk. Really tuning in, from where do you listen? From your hearts? From your body? How might, as you listen, experience listening as itself a form of communication? That full presence of mindfulness of sati. Meeting experience without needing to change it or fix it. What is the gift we give in our listening? Want to share this is one of my favorite books. It's called Undrowned, and it's by Alexis Pauline Gums, and she has they're called Black Feminist Lessons from Marine Mammals, and every chapter she's speaking to and learning from a different marine mammal. And this one is her relationship with river dolphins. And she writes, "I am amazed by how much listening can do. How quickly it becomes less important to be seen, to leap, to show. And those who study river dolphins know it too. Don't bother looking for these teachers who will rarely jump or splash. You have to listen for them. Try to hear them breathe. I breathe in shape. I shape my days while land contours me at two sides. I shape my breath to wind through winding paths ahead. I shape my head to fit the purpose of my breath. My breath is prayer, the shape of life, evolving name. All I can see is just the blur that says life moves. I stay in prayer and reach to listen for your breath. Let's sit together for a few minutes. May you feel the support of this community, of the earth, of the Dharma. May you be nourished. May you feel held. May you allow your sense of meaning and purpose to unfold and bloom. May you go to the places that scare you. May you not let limited conceptions of yourself get in the way of life living through you. Thank you for your kind attention. ended a little early, so we have a walking period for about 20 minutes. At 8:50, there will be the last sit of the day. And actually, one more announcement I meant to make earlier is a request to continue to mask in the indoor areas, please. Thank you.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.